Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. As pharmaceutical giants race one another to create a vaccine for COVID-19, the big questions are, how much will a vaccine cost and who will have access? Today's guest, investigative journalist Gerald Posner, says the House of Representatives missed a huge opportunity when they passed a $3 trillion stimulus package with no anti-profiteering language to stop Big Pharma from charging big money for COVID treatments and vaccines. This comes as taxpayers are underwriting billions in public research. Gerald Posner says the pharmaceutical industry has lobbied both Democrats and Republicans to shape coronavirus relief. In his latest book, Pharma, Greed, Lies, and the Poisoning of America, he explores the history of the pharmaceutical industry and argues they have long put profits over their duty to develop drugs for the public good. Gerald Posner is an award-winning journalist and New York Times best-selling author of several books. His latest is called Pharma, Greed, Lies, and the Poisoning of America. His book came out on March 10th, just days before the World Health Organization declared COVID-19 a pandemic. And Gerald Posner joins us from his home in Miami. Hi, Gerald. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rose. Nice to be back with you.
Well, it's great to have you, Gerald. We had you on recently asking the very same question, how much will these treatments cost and who will have access? I have to say, Gerald, I've been kind of surprised that this issue is not getting more attention.
You know, I am as well, Rose, but I tell you, I think that is because what I'm seeing play out, and as we've had these conversations over the last few weeks, I have an evolving view of it, and that is that pharma, I should have known from 5 years of research and having done a book about how they've gamed the system in the past at public health crises, that they would not be foolish enough to come out and just ask for an amazingly high, staggering price. They've done that in the past on HIV drugs, the first AZT drug. We talked about that. They priced it $10,000, which was then a record, and after a lot of protest, only lowered it to $8,000. So they're capable of doing absolutely outrageous things. But this time, I think they realize that they can't come up with a price that's so high because they're taking hundreds of millions of dollars or billions of dollars worldwide in public money to get to these vaccines. And this is my sort of speculative view of where they're heading. I think that I see Johnson & Johnson talking about giving the vaccine at near cost in the beginning. You see Moderna is taking a lot of money and just had a successful small little trial with antibodies the other day. They got a lot of hoopla. They're talking about keeping the prices down. And I think what the deal is going to be, essentially, is the pharmaceutical industry is going to sort of get this promise from the U.S. government that in exchange for a reasonably priced vaccine at a price per dose that's affordable to the government, they want no controls on drug pricing. Period. And that's what I think may be in the play, because there's always talk about the overall question of drug pricing. They would love to be able to hit a deal like that. It's not a quid pro quo in the sense that you can sign the dotted line, but to the extent that they help the government out by not gouging on it, don't worry, they're going to keep the door open on the rest of the pipeline, which will make up the bulk of their sales every year by far.
Right. Okay, so that's pricing. I mean, do you think that over time it will change? Do you think that in the beginning they might stick to what they say and then over time start charging high prices?
Well, I think that, I mean, there are two parts of that. So first of all, when Johnson & Johnson and Glaxo say we're going to give it a cost, okay, first of all, you have to think there are two elements. There's the cost to actually manufacture it, and then they get a distribution cost as well. And although that may not seem like a big difference, they sometimes build a larger profit into one than the other. So their cost is what they calculate. But even on top of that, the only way they're going to do that is if they believe that it will be something that's a recurring vaccine, that it has to be given out, not necessarily like the flu vaccine, influenza every year, it changes, but that COVID's going to stay around, and that if nothing else, you may need a booster shot. The booster shots in subsequent years will be the ones where they make the big money, and also the governments all around the world are going to have to stockpile this vaccine. So that's something that, and that they're not saying, by the way, we'll give you a cost. There's the numbers are clear on this, you know, in the sense that if you're looking at the biggest vaccine makers right now, they're really, from people like Sanofi, they make about $2 billion a year on their influenza vaccine. That's what they're bringing in. And I think that the largest of any of these right now is Pfizer's Prevnar, which is a pneumonia vaccine given to people over 65, and then sometimes they have to get a second dose. That's bringing in about $6 billion a year. But forecasts are that for the COVID vaccine, I've seen estimates as high as $30 billion from 2020 to 2022 for a company. That's a gold mine. That's 6 years of Prevnar sales. So you're talking about an enormous market with possibly recurring sales, and that's why the pharmaceutical companies are drooling at the prospects.
The other question I've been thinking a lot about, Gerald, is how is this going to be rolled out? Because places like the Global South, Brazil, indigenous people in the Amazon, Mumbai, I mean, they're getting hit really hard. The Navajo Nation here in the United States is getting hit so hard. How is this going to be rolled out?
Well, you know, there you ask one of the key questions that nobody, it's not a first world question, but it should be a first world question because it's the first world pumping in the money for research. It's the first world pharmaceutical companies who are reaping the big profits, often off of their drugs that are sold in the developed world. And that question won't be answered until we know what the vaccine is. And the reason I say that is it's most likely going to be an injection, and that then does create all of the problems you're talking about in every area where you need medical personnel to try to be able to not only distribute it in massive numbers, but all the hygiene, the cleanliness, the sterilization, the possibilities that needles will never be reused, all those things that have happened in the past on injectable vaccines in developing nations that have been terrible. And in addition to that, there will be some push for an oral vaccine, but that's unlikely. An oral vaccine would be like the polio vaccine in the 60s, Albert Sabin's vaccine, but that was an attenuated virus, Rose, which means that it had a little bit of live virus in it. It was so strong, they were able to put it into a sugar cube, but they knew that immunosuppressed people and of people that are genetically predisposed to get it in every million instances of the vaccine being given out, there would be a few instances of people developing polio, and that happened. So they have to run that risk with an oral vaccine. So oral vaccine, easier to give out, no question about it. You don't need medical personnel as much. You can distribute it, but a higher risk. So we have to see what the eventual one looks like.
Gerald, can you talk to us about what it takes to actually make a vaccine? What goes into it?
You know, there is an interesting process because there's two things. In the traditional times, it's been finding for a virus, and this is the difficult part. You know, people think of a vaccine, it doesn't work against things like the bubonic plague. It doesn't work against things that had been before tuberculosis. Those were bacterial infections. It works only in the instance of a virus. Viruses that come into, they need a host. They don't have legs of their own. Therefore, they can't survive unless they find humans. They find humans, they get into us, and they latch onto a receptor. This one latches on in COVID to a receptor in the lung. But they're all different. And sometimes they're smart enough to be able to, you know, change over time so that they become a little bit more virulent or they become more dangerous to the host. But the host needs to be there, and that's us. So what the vaccines do, they're looking in the lab right now for vaccines that interfere with the replication of the virus. The virus won't be allowed to grow as fast. The faster it grows, the faster it replicates. It takes over the lungs, the respiratory tracts. That's why people have trouble breathing. They develop the equivalent of a very severe case of pneumonia, and they're ventilated in the most severe cases in an attempt to save them. So if you slow the replication up, you might also allow other treatments that are now under investigation to come in and hold the virus off from being able to replicate fast enough to be fatal. That's really what the vaccine is doing, is to give you the ability to fight it off, maybe getting a little sick, but not nearly as sick as you would have before. So they're looking right now for those, the equivalent of those slowing mechanisms in the lab. And one little footnote, there are two companies that are chasing a vaccine that would be the first in human history, and that's this what I call an RNA vaccine. It really is a genetic code. It would be masked to our genes in a way that nothing else ever has and would sort of boost the genes to be able to fight the vaccine off. That's Moderna, and it's a Pfizer and small biotech hunt. There's never been a successful effort to get one of those vaccines made. This would be the first of its type, but they are also chasing that right now, so it would be interesting to see what happens.
What can you tell us about Moderna? I'm sure for a lot of people, they're just hearing about this company for the first time. They're getting a lot of positive media attention about their March trial. All eight patients who received two doses of the vaccine developed antibodies to the virus. What do you think about how the media are covering this?
Yeah, no, I think the media coverage of Moderna has been basically terrible because it's been like cheerleaders. And what I mean by that is, look, we should all be excited. I don't want to sound like a Grinch who's sitting here and saying, oh, you know, gee, you showed some positive results in your test and I'm not happy for you. I'm happy for them. I'm happy for any company that's able to get a treatment or work on a vaccine to market, because we need it as a society, and every country needs it eventually. So we're keeping an eye on the pricing, but we don't want to just sit there as journalists, I think, and sort of cheer them on and cover them as each and every development is another breakthrough that's going to change the status of how we deal with COVID. And Moderna is a perfect example. They literally came out, with these first human results from what's the smallest of all the trials of phase one file of their mRNA vaccine candidate. Okay, what it was on eight people, all right? Only eight. All eight patients who received two doses of this experimental vaccine, they didn't tell you how much, but they were just told you two doses, got an antibody response. We've been hearing a lot about that with COVID, you know, people showing in these serologic test antibodies that could confer some immunity. We don't know how much, for how long. There are a lot of questions about it. But that was exciting to see that at least it did make the antibodies. It was possible, Rose, they did the test and didn't get any at all. Here's the part that aggravates me with Moderna and the way it's been covered in the press. What Moderna did at that point was essentially a vaccine promotional tour. They had like a marketing tour that was on. It was a one-day tour. They talked about it. They sent out PR releases. They had press people go out. And the stock went 20% higher on that day. The company dumped almost 18 million shares into the market. Nothing illegal with that, but they issued another 18 million shares at that high valuation. So they are carrying a multi-million dollar value, billion dollar valuation, larger than anything else in biotech right now. It's remarkable. And my feeling is there's just something untoward about the company hyping it as promotion, seeing the stock price jump up, and then dumping more shares into the market, and nobody even really mentions that. So then the last thing that puts the icing on the cake for me in some ways is that President Trump's selection to sort of run his vaccine a program that will be the crash program to get a vaccine is a Moderna director, Moncef Saloui. He has a great reputation, but he resigned from Moderna's board when he was appointed, but clearly Moderna has the odds tilted in its favor in terms of having the head of the vaccine crash program having been a director there.
So this is a $1.5 billion equity offering that Moderna filed for yesterday. According to Reuters, the U.S. government backed Moderna's vaccine in April with $483 million in funding from BARDA, the Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority. Can you tell us more about the significance of this, Gerald, and how this works?
Yeah, I think it's very interesting. Of course, BARDA, we recently saw, where Bright had to leave, fired, dismissed, and has turned to a whistleblower to say that he thought that he wasn't being listened to. BARDA is, the money that comes from BARDA is critical because Moderna is essentially working with the National Institutes of Health, which is inside the Health and Human Services. They are getting the guidance and the research and the money from the government. That's why I do think that it will be hard for Moderna necessarily to turn around and charge an exorbitant price to the U.S. government, because they are a U.S. government creation. I don't mean that in terms of Moderna being a creation. They're a biotech company for a long time with this idea that they could do something with this unusual technology. If it works for Moderna, though, they will not only be at the forefront of this mRNA world, but they will be able to use the research that they had. And this is the part that's key, I think, Rose. All of these companies in the past, when they got massive infusions of government money, even from World War II when the government made it, I write about this in Pharma, gave it to them for penicillin. Even when we gave them the money that was used to develop the polio vaccines, both Salk and Sabin, even when we gave them the money and paid high prices on the swine flu vaccine in 76, they take that research and then they not only use it to come out with the drug, but they use it for ancillary drugs. The research teaches them things about their own technology and processes that they wouldn't have had the money for otherwise. So the hundreds of millions of dollars that have gone to Moderna that they are now using on trying to develop this vaccine, let's assume for a second that they don't get it. Maybe Pfizer and BioNTech, which is another competing vaccine, gets there first on the same technology. They will still have nothing to pay back to the government, or the taxpayer, I should say. We are the ones funding it. And they will use that research to be able to advance their own mRNA drugs for other treatments that they will treat for genetic illnesses or whatever. And those will be priced at high prices. It will earn them billions of dollars. The taxpayer will never see any of that, nor will anything come back to Health and Human Services or to BARDA. That's the unfortunate part of this as well.
Today we are speaking with investigative journalist Gerald Posner. He's out with a new book, Pharma, Greed, Lies, and the Poisoning of America. It came out just a couple of days before the WHO declared COVID-19 a pandemic. And we're talking with Gerald about how much COVID treatments and a vaccine will cost and who will have access. Very important questions. If you have any comments about this or if you have any overall questions about Big Pharma, Jared spent 5 years on his book. We'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. or tweet at Your Call Radio. Gerald, one of your recent tweets was about the $3 trillion stimulus bill that just passed the House. And you said that there was no anti-profiteering language to stop pharma from charging big money for treatments at a time when taxpayers are underwriting billions in public research. You've done so much studying and research on Big Pharma and the influence these companies have on Republicans and Democrats. Talk about this, how significant it was that this was missing from this House bill.
I mean, I sound like I just fell off a turnip truck or something, because it's hard to imagine that I actually say I was flabbergasted, but I really was flabbergasted because I thought it was a no-brainer for the House bill that just passed last week, the so-called HEROES Act, to include something about a prohibition on what would be called a sort of anti-profiteering language for drug companies. Jan Schakowsky, the representative from Illinois, had put together a bill at the end of last year called the Metric Act that was pushing transparency in the pharmaceutical supply chain. It was a good bill. It sat there. Nobody was really backing it at all. They pushed it aside. There was a recent effort in April to move it along, but didn't have the leadership support. The Republicans were against it because they were saying, the typical Republican refrain that we hear now on these types of bills was anti-competitive, quote-unquote, and was like a government takeover of the drug industry. So anything like that, they just stand up in unison and say no. Then I thought, okay, COVID gives us an unintended possibility for something good. It can give us the chance for a progressive move on putting together some language about controlling drug prices, or at least negotiating them, doing what we do in Europe, not being the only country in the world that allows them unfettered power to call their own prices. So in March and April of this year, a handful of progressives, 6 and 8 at different times, wanted safeguards in those 4 relief packages that, as I call it, anti-profiteering language. The 4 senior members of the House had asked for it publicly and got nothing. And after the HEROES Act was passed, Lloyd Doggett, the representative from Texas who's been on this issue, he said that, well, that bill, I think it was nearly, 18 or 1,900 pages long, contained a lot of excellent provisions. Big Pharma, and this is a quote I remember, is unfortunately once again a big winner. And the House Democrats, the leadership, Nancy Pelosi, know that that bill, as they sent it in, the $3 trillion bill, which addresses so many good things, is not going to get passed in that form by the Senate and Mitch McConnell. They will have talking, meaning the House, the Democrats will have talking points for the November election to say, we wanted to do X, Y, and Z, and the Republicans blocked it. Why not include language about restricting excessive profiting on drugs, even if you know it's not going to make the final bill. You can then say, we were in favor of this. So what is it about the drug companies? I should know, after having done this 100-year history, because I see it time and time again. The last real effort to control it was in 1962 with Estes Gafalfa, this crusading senator from Tennessee, and that got scuttled by the drug industry on pricing. They couldn't shorten the patents. Became instead safety legislation after the thalidomide, this disaster with a drug in Europe that caused horrible birth deformities. So everybody got scared about safety, and they focused on safety, not on drugs, and we've never done it since. But I couldn't believe that we didn't even include it in the HEROES Act.
Wow. Gerald, can you talk about the power of the lobby? Citizens for Ethics reports that over the last decade, Big Pharma has spent $2.5 billion lobbying the federal government.
Yes. The reason I say yes and you, that hesitation is not that I'm surprised at the number, and I talk about pharma lobbying a lot in here, but I think that it's an underreported number. And I understand this is a number that legally has to be reported, but it's sort of like political campaigns, Rose. You know, you can only contribute so much as an individual to a federal campaign, a state campaign, local campaign. And then there's soft money. You can set up a PAC if you want to for your favorite candidate, and if you have $1 billion, you can spend it or that, and you just can't coordinate with them. So in pharma lobbying, they have direct money that they pay that they record when somebody's a lobbyist for them. That's that $2.5 billion. But they spend a lot of money in what I call cozying up, friendly. They're not buying votes and by taking people out to dinner or sending them down to Bermuda for a holiday in the old sort of crass way that things used to be done in the 50s or 60s. But they're making deals in terms of where they're building their next plant. So if you're Johnson & Johnson, you're talking about making 900 to a billion doses of the COVID vaccine. Guess what? You need a new plant. Bill Gates said about 5 days ago that he might be willing to contribute some of his billions toward the manufacturing of a new plant. The federal government might help to offset some of the cost of those new plants. And we built all those plants with the enormous tanks that were needed for fermentation in World War II for penicillin. When the war was over, all the companies like Pfizer and the rest had these enormous new plants that helped them dominate the drug industry. We'll build the plants now, maybe some at taxpayer expense. And the drug companies will negotiate with some state leaders and some federal leaders to say, where are we going to build it? You want it in Illinois? Maybe we can put it in Texas. What are you going to give us in this? Will you stand up for us on the next bill? So there's this jockeying that takes place behind the scenes. And pharma's lobbying arm is excellent at doing it. So the $2.5 billion, take that as the window dressing. That's what they do just in terms of going in and saying, you know, don't vote for this bill. But they're clever, and they have the clout because of their size. Remember, $500 billion in revenues just from the top 10 firms to be able to make offers about state production and distribution lines that can affect jobs and get the attention of lawmakers.
And then there's the revolving door. And after a quick break, we will talk about Dr. Moncef Slaoui, a former pharma executive, was announced last week as a lead figure in the Trump administration's push for a vaccine. He resigned as director of the company Moderna. He continues to hold stock options worth more than $10 million in the company. This is according to Business Insider. Today, we are joined by Gerald Posner, an award-winning journalist and New York Times best-selling author of several books, including his latest, Pharma, Greed, Lies, and the Poisoning of America. This book came out just a couple of days before the WHO declared COVID-19 a pandemic. Gerald spent 5 years of research on this very important book. We're going to take a quick break. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
This is Ben Trefney, news director here at KALW, appreciating your call so much because having access to fact-based original journalism is so essential, especially today. There's so much information going around. Your call helps us make sense of it. I appreciate being able to hear it. I hope that you do too. And I hope that you'll become a member of KALW during our very, very short 3-day membership drive. You could go to kalw.org. Or you can call 800-525-9917. That's 800-525-9917. Your Call is part of a broad array of programming that we bring you from all around the world, from the nation, from partners like the BBC, from NPR, and of course, from our team with Your Call, Malia Hirazazan and Rose Aguilar, and then our news department as well, where we've been ramping up our coverage so we could bring you all the information you need to know, and our new partners like Capital Public Radio News. This is the package that you get when you support KALW. If you support other public media in the Bay Area, it does not come to support us. We need your support right now, specifically at KALW. You keep us alive. Go to kalw.org. And I want to note something else, Rose. We have a challenge here. We're trying to get 20 calls or clicks by 11 a.m. to keep us on track for this very short drive. And that means in this break, before we go back to your conversation with Gerald Posner, that we need to get 10 calls or clicks in the next 5 minutes. And I know that we can do it because listeners care about Your Call. They care about good information. And they care about you, Rose. So please come with us. Join the family at KALW at kalw.org.
800-525-9917, 800-525-9917, or kalw.org. 20 calls or clicks by the end of the hour, and we will make that challenge. Thank you so much for your support. Supporting Your Call is so crucial, especially during COVID. We are following the money. We're asking important questions about treatments and vaccines. How much will it cost? How will it be rolled out? Tomorrow, we're going to talk more about testing and contact tracing, and then we'll talk about the state of the economy. This is the kind of radio that you are supporting by calling 800-525-9917, 800-525-9917. We're hoping to get 20 calls or clicks by the end of the hour to make our challenge. You can also go online to kalw.org. This is the first day of our 3-day membership drive. So let's start this off strong.
This is the shortest.
Thanks for coming in, Ben.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you. This is the shortest membership drive that I can remember ever at KALW. And we really need people to step up when they hear this message to make it happen. Go to kalw.org. Like you said, Rose, we have a 20 call or click challenge in this hour. We need 10 calls or clicks in the next 5 minutes. That's right now. Go to kalw.org, and let me give you a reason why it's so important to do right at this moment. Because if you become a sustaining member at $10 a month or more, $50 a month perhaps, but if you become a sustaining member where it's sort of like your internet bill, or it's like your newspaper bill or your phone bill, it's something that you're billed monthly, then you are going to have those dollars all doubled for a year. Thanks to Judith Adams, a very generous supporter of KALW, up to $10,000 she's willing to give, but only for people who become sustaining members today. So please go to kalw.org, become a sustaining member, and there's an additional gift that you'll get, a one-year subscription to Babbel, the online language learning app. So in this time when we're all sheltering in place, great time to learn a language and great time to support KALW. Go to kalw.org to make it happen, and together we're going to meet this challenge. Thank you so much.
Thank you. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we're joined by Gerald Posner, award-winning journalist and New York Times bestselling author of several books. His latest is Pharma, Greed, Lies, and the Poisoning of America. Gerald spent 5 years doing research on this book. If you have any questions for Gerald about what he found, he looked at the history of the pharmaceutical industry. If you've got questions about COVID treatments and a vaccine, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. Gerald, we have a question for you from a listener. Would you please talk about the anti-vax movement and Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s role as a leading critic of vaccines, including platforming Mikovits featured in Plandemic? I think he undermines an important component of public health. Thank you. And Plandemic, this is a new documentary that's out. Is that right?
Yeah, or it's sort of a trailer, actually, for a book by Judy Mikovits, who was a researcher that had worked with Fauci and a lot of other people. And okay. And she sets out, and it's a very well done, when you watch it, it's moving and seems credible and everything else. Mikovits was there. Some of the information that she passes along, the facts are right, but then she draws these big, broad conclusions from about information that she wouldn't know into a grand conspiracy involving Bill Gates and Fauci and other government leaders that I think goes far too afield. So the question is, if you back off, although I know she, you know, it's wildly popular, I don't find it as credible. But if you take the core information there, the core complaints that she has about the way vaccines are pushed, there is a point. You know, you have an anti-vaccine movement that isn't necessarily based on science. I talk about it. I write about it in the book. Its origins are in a Lancet article by Dr. Wakefield and 11 other doctors that seemed at the time very promising when he found results of what would be autism from children that had taken a trio dose vaccine. As it turned out over time, they didn't pick those children just as part of a random study, but they had been given to them by plaintiffs' lawyers in Britain who were suing the vaccine companies, and it turned out that some of the data was falsified. So the other 11 doctors with Wakefield all disowned the study. Lancet did a retraction, and then he was struck from the medical register. His medical license was taken away. So that was a bad study. It doesn't mean that somebody else in the future won't be able to find that link, but he didn't find it. But as a result of that, and he's been on the lecture circuit, a lot of people have embraced the anti-vaccine movement, believe that it's dangerous, and they don't want their children vaccinated. They don't want themselves vaccinated. And that is an issue for the government coming up, Rose, because if they roll out a national inoculation program, they haven't had one since 1976 when they tried on swine flu, and they inoculated only 40 million people then because it turned out swine flu wasn't as virulent as they had feared. It wasn't around that year. But what are they going to do? How will they force people to do it? Won't you be able to send your children to school if they don't have a vaccine, even though they're at lower risk? Will you not be able to get on a plane? The FAA controls that. They can issue a federal directive that says no vaccine, you don't get on the plane. So as that plays out, it's going to be very interesting. Mandatory medicine has never been popular with Americans, the science aside from it. And I don't think it will be popular here in many ways, even though it may be the healthy thing to do. I think there will be a lot of resistance to it.
Wow. Well, thank you for the question. You can tweet us at Your Call Radio. You can email yourcall@kalw.org, or you can call us 800-525. Actually, that's our pledge number. It's been a long morning. We're in our pledge drive right now, Gerald, and we've been up since about 6 asking people to support KALW. 800-525-9917. There's the phone number. And we've got a couple of listeners on the line, so let's go to Robert in San Francisco. Hi, Robert. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I was wondering what you thought of remdesivir. I understand it costs about 92 cents a dose to manufacture, and they haven't settled on a price. And they're not rolling it out.
And
it seems to Dr. Gottlieb seems to think it would be effective as a therapeutic for this COVID thing.
Right, and I did hear the 93 cents, and Dr. Gottlieb, I just missed what the drug was. He cut out for half a second.
Oh, the remdesivir.
Oh yeah, look, remdesivir, very inexpensive. What I believe is critical, and this is something I can't emphasize enough, there are instances of this time and time again at public health crises in our past in this country when it comes to the drug companies, is don't rush the science. You do it at your own peril. So if remdesivir is effective, it would be a relatively inexpensive way to be able to offset some of the problems inside hospitals and in treatments. But the science isn't there yet. Some of the studies, there's anecdotal evidence, there hasn't been a full clinical trial. And if you try to rush it, get ahead of the scientists, then you become the guinea pig for that drug. So people want to rush ahead. You know, the president wants to use remdesivir, and other people listen to him, think it's a good idea, and they want to take it. Fine. They are then part, essentially, of this trial that's playing out in front of us. We will find out if A, it's effective, and B, if there are bad side effects, and if the side effects overwhelm the good effects. But it's a dangerous process to try to jump ahead of what we actually know. We're all anxious to do it. We're all impatient, but it's difficult to do.
Right. Another question about access. Gilead CEO Daniel O'Day, Gilead makes remdesivir, says that they're committed to, quote, making sure the medicine is accessible and affordable to patients around the world, end quote. But according to Bloomberg, Wall Street is pressuring Gilead about profits. What are your thoughts on this?
Oh, I mean, Gilead is really, excuse me, sorry about that. I've also been up at an early time, but I haven't been doing the good deed that you've been doing, which is raising money for KLW. So it's different, which I grew up on, by the way, a San Francisco native, so I know how important that station is. Gilead does not have, it has a checkered history. Gilead was the drug company that had the NIH, the National Institute of Health, with all public research, develop a prophylaxis for HIV that's now marketed as Truvada by Gilead. They had nothing to do with that except for supplying the material that was used by the NIH to be able to develop the drug. And as a matter of fact, records show that have become public that Gilead thought there was no commercial market in that type of drug for HIV, reducing the viral load in HIV patients. It didn't cure it. Why would anyone be interested in that? Then when somebody explained to them that they might be able to market it as a way to have, together with safer sex, reduce the HIV infection numbers, they did market it, and they're making $5 to $6 billion a year. Nothing's come back to the U.S. government. They went to court to get the patent. So their history hasn't been great. And on remdesivir, you know, I protested the fact that when they first tried to fast-track it at the FDA in light of COVID, they tried to get a special designation for it called an orphan drug status. All you need to know, Rose, for your listeners, is I have a chapter called Billion Dollar Orphans. It's a part of the law that drug companies have learned to game successfully with loopholes that should be closed tomorrow, but it's not. And Gilead tried to slip it in under this special provision that would give them tax credits, special subsidies, an extra seven-year patent. The protest from those who knew it was so loud that they had to reverse themselves 5 days later. So when Gilead says, we're going to be fair with you, I feel like I'm talking to the used car salesman who says, you know, I'm going to give you a great price on that drug. And they are trying to get a little bit better with PR. I saw just today, I believe it was, that they had previously planned, I guess, on donating about 600,000 doses of remdesivir. They're now going to donate about 950,000, they told the Health and Human Services. So don't worry. They will make up on that million donation of remdesivir big time when they eventually get it, if they get it approved as a treatment for COVID.
These numbers sound big, but when you're talking about a global pandemic, they're very small.
Yes, absolutely, but they sound impressive. You're right. What you have to do is stand back for a second, as you do, you know, and you put your reporter's lens on it as a journalist, and you say, boy, you're giving nearly a million doses free, and then you realize, of course, we're talking potentially, even in a treatment, forget a vaccine for a second, a treatment that's effective that keeps people from dying in a resurgence or phase two of the virus could literally be given out 10 to 20 or 30 million times at the drop of a hat in one country like India. So, you know, the numbers here are potentially enormous for them.
Well, exactly. And also the timing, Gerald, because you said India. I mean, thinking of Mumbai, where COVID has really just taken off because there's just no way for people living in the slums of Mumbai to physically distance. And so, again, the vaccine is being covered on a regular basis in the media. The Trump administration is talking about it on a regular basis. But we're still a year or maybe a year and a half out, right?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, you know, everybody talks about it as though it's only a matter of time. And, you know, I always try to remind people, and it's clear, you know, and you know this from in the book, Rose, where I talk about HIV. They've been trying to get a vaccine for HIV since 1985 with no success. Last year, for those who are watching, in 2019, the FDA finally approved a vaccine for Ebola. And that, you know, that was from the 1970s when first discovered. So they can be very difficult to get to. People who are involved in the science believe they will get one here because they've been working with coronaviruses since about 2004 and 5 when SARS and MERS broke out. So there's some research already there, and I think they will as well. But you're talking literally in that year to year and a half or more, you'll not only have the problem of COVID spreading, but it's going to spread in different ways. So that, for instance, in India, in the South Sudan, where I just saw a piece the other day that the BBC had, which is an amazing piece, or, you know, in countries without the same, torn by war or conflict, or without the same sanitary conditions, without running water in every place and in every home, COVID will spread also through feces, as other diseases do, and it won't necessarily be airborne. And once that starts to happen, it's a faster process of spreading. That's what happened in the 1700s and 1800s in the U.S. when diseases spread in tightly crammed tenements in Philadelphia and New York and other places and spread so quickly. And so we're going to see, I think, the same thing playing out here. You don't need to worry about social distancing. You need to worry about the water that you're using in a village that may be infected because somebody had COVID, and unfortunately it's not cleansed or not purified before it's being used.
Doctors Without Borders goes to these parts of the world. In fact, they just recently decided to go to the Navajo Nation, where 1 in 3 Navajo families do not have a sink or a toilet. We just did a show about that a few weeks ago. Gerald, Doctors Without Borders is calling on governments to remove patents on testing, treatments, and vaccines. This deserves more attention because patents could prevent generic, lower-cost versions of drugs. So where do we stand right now on patents?
You know, it's so amazing because the patent is really the monopoly golden lock that the pharmaceutical company uses. And the idea of patents, you know, the idea that it would give some entrepreneur, some woman or man who developed a really innovative type of device or drug or whatever that changed the way we thought of older treatments and gave us some new progress, would be able to protect themselves from these large companies that came in and competed against them. The patent would allow them to sell it under their brand name exclusively. Well, of course, who owns the patents today? It's not the little entrepreneurs or scientists or researchers inside the labs. They've signed their rights over for large salaries to the drug companies. The drug companies own the patents. They manipulate them to get extensions on them with slight chemical or modifications of atoms and a little bit of the molecules, so they're a little bit different in terms of dispensing them. Maybe it can be given 2 times instead of 3 times, or in a shot instead of an intravenous application, but the drug's essentially the same. It renews the patent for another 17 years. They can get it extended up to 20 in the U.S., and patents strangle competition. They keep prices high. They keep others out of the market. Doctors Without Borders is right. So is a group out of Norway called CEPIA, Coalition for Epidemics and Pandemics, which has been arguing for the last 5 years that this information should be shared and is public research. You know, Rose, I have a chapter titled, Can You Patent the Sun?, which is a quote that was given on the polio vaccine by Jonas Salk, who invented it. He was asked in a radio interview, who owns the patent? You, the drug company. He said, no, it's like a product of nature. Can you patent the sun? Of course not. But he's the exception. There's nobody else that I can cite like that. So today, patents are used to lock things up at high prices, and we can, we meaning the U.S. government, can use a little-known section of the law, what I call 1498. You can 1498 it, which means you can essentially do eminent domain on a patent if it's for the public good. So if Moderna came out with a vaccine and said it's $1 million a person, some crazy number, they're not going to do that, but if they did, the government could say, okay, we're using this section of the law to take your patent, we're going to manufacture it at cost, and we're going to distribute it. Now, Moderna would fight them in court, it would go up to the Supreme Court, but and it's never been done, but it's been done in other areas. That's the real hammer we have, but no, look at, Rose, if Democrats and Republicans won't put in language in a draft bill on the pandemic in the middle of the COVID-19 crisis to control drug prices, even in a draft, we're not going to get them to use a hammer in the law to take away a company's patent, unfortunately.
Mm. Well, let's hear from another caller. Let's go to Dory in San Francisco. Hi, Dory. Thanks for holding.
Hey, Rose. And hi, Gerald. I wanted
to
follow up on Moderna. And maybe I heard you incorrectly, but I thought you said that it's now become the largest market cap in biotech, which is, I mean, it's an outlandish valuation, but it's far, far, far from the top. Amgen's at like $130 billion, and now with this financing, Moderna's at $30 billion, and many other companies are higher than Moderna. But I would say that Moderna right now may be the most important biotech because of all eyes looking at it, because it's in the lead in the vaccine race. But a few things I want to just follow up on. One is that if, and I think it's a long shot, but if Moderna is successful, the odds are there are two other mRNA-based vaccines, and one's being developed by Pfizer and BioNTech, and the other by Arcturus. They're likely to succeed also. And there's going to be more than one vaccine eventually in all probability. So Moderna is probably not going to nearly make the money that people think. You're correct. The federal government, because it has leverage, because they gave the $483 billion grant, they'll also, you know, have leverage to limit what Moderna can price. But also J&J, which is an excellent track record in developing, you know, this kind, these kinds of therapeutics and vaccines, they've already said they've committed to selling its vaccine, if it's successful, at cost. And they've pledged to make 1 billion doses or more per year. So Moderna, you know, probably is not going to be, if they're successful, they're not going to be the only vaccine player. Others that use mRNA like Moderna also will be successful if Moderna is successful. And then you've got other players like J&J that's not going to make a profit on it. So I just wanted to bring that up for you.
Yeah, no, it's a good point. And we did talk a little bit about J&J not making a profit on the first batch that they will do at cost, but they will make money on stockpiling by governments and also subsequent years and booster shots. But that's a separate issue. But on Moderna, a very good point, which is whoever gets there first, once they get there, it's not as though every other company, 86, are, you know, are in the race, and 14 or 15 really have are what I call in the short list of having a shot at it. They're not just going to wrap up, close the door, and say, ah, we got beat. That's the end of it. He's absolutely right. Pfizer and BioNTech, they're working on the same technology, mRNA, so they will be chasing to come in second, and if they get first, Moderna will be after them. And then other companies like Johnson & Johnson, who committed a lot of money to developing this vaccine, they are using a different method, but they're going to be competing as well. So I think that's absolutely right. But the one who gets there first will be the one in the driver's seat in some ways, because governments all want this right away. Unless COVID starts to peter away on its own, the infection numbers are falling, and at the time the vaccine comes out in a year, Rose, people aren't afraid anymore or as panicked or as nervous, then it might be different. But if COVID is still in the daily news and affecting our lives and causing deaths, that first company to get in will be in the driver's seat in many ways.
Gerald, we have about a minute left. We're going to have you back because there's so much we didn't get to talk about. You recently tweeted that you thought it was impossible that the Sacklers might avoid paying fully for their role in the opioid crisis, but you underestimated the degree to which COVID coverage has permitted them to operate in the dark. So we want you to talk about that. You spent 5 years on this book. You said that a lot of people spoke to you off the record for fear of retribution. You sifted through thousands of overlooked government regulatory documents. Final thoughts, Gerald, just on, you know, the connections to what we're talking about today with COVID, just how this industry works and what people need to know.
Rose, I just say that, you know, what I hear from people who have read the book and they come back to me, they say, now I understand it. I had a feeling that something was wrong with pharma. I had a feeling that they weren't necessarily doing things in our best interest, even though some drugs can be life-saving or that. But what happened is, even a section called Targeting Women, about what they did in the 60s and 70s in selling hormone replacement and oral contraceptives that they knew inside had levels of hormones so high that they would be causing cancers and blood clots, and got away with it for 15 years. There's a history here of putting profits ahead of people, done time and time again by companies that we know. And although they do some great inventions and come out with drugs that are important, I just say we have to keep an eye on each and every level of something like a public health crisis like COVID-19, because if past is prologue, the past is not very great here. It's a history of delving in, picking up the last penny, pushing it as much as possible. And in the United States, they get away with more than in any other country, unfortunately.
Gerald, can you stick around with us for about a minute during our pitching?
Absolutely.
Great. Thank you. Gerald Posner is an award-winning investigative journalist and New York Times bestselling author of several books, including his latest, Pharma, Greed, Lies, and the Poisoning of America. And we will continue asking these very important questions. How much will treatments and a vaccine cost, and who will have access? Find out more about Gerald's work at yourcallradio.org. This is Your Call. Thank you so much for joining us.